Chapter 59. Hollis paced beside the postage stamp-sized landing pad that the Lady Flamborough's crew had hurriedly fabricated over the swimming pool. A carrier pigeon helicopter settled onto the pad as a small team of men waited to board. Hollis stopped when he heard a fresh outburst of gunfire from the direction of the mine, his face reflecting concern. "Load and get 'em airborne," he shouted impatiently to Dillinger. "Somebody's alive up there and fighting our battle." "The mine must have been the hijacker's escape point," said Captain Collins, who paced at Hollis's side. "And thanks to me, Dirk Pitt and his friends stumbled right into them," snapped Hollis. "Any way you can get there in time to save them and the hostages?" asked Collins. Hollis shook his head in grim despair. "Not one chance in hell." Rudy Gunn was thankful for the sudden downpour of heavy rain. It effectively shielded him as he crawled away from the crushing mill under a string of empty ore cars. Once clear of the buildings, he dropped down the mountain below the mine for a few hundred meters and then circled back. He found the narrow-gauge tracks and began walking silently on the crossties. He could see only a short distance around him, but within a few minutes of escaping the terrorists' assault on the crushing mill, he froze in position when his eyes distinguished several vague figures through the rain ahead. He counted 4 sitting and 2 standing. Gunn faced a dilemma. He assumed the hostages were resting while the guards stood. But he couldn't shoot and check his assumption later. He would have to rely on his borrowed terrorist clothing to bluff his way close enough to tell friend from foe. His only drawback, and a vital one, was he only knew 2 or 3 words of Arabic. Gunn took a breath and walked forward. He said, "Salam," repeating the word 2 more times in a calm, controlled voice. The 2 figures who were standing took on more detail as he approached, and he saw they held machine guns lowered and pointed his way. One of them replied with words Gunn couldn't interpret. He mentally crossed his fingers and hoped they had asked the Arabic equivalent of "Who goes there?" "Muhammad," he mumbled, relying on the Prophet's name to carry him through, while lazily holding the heckler and cock across his chest with the muzzle aimed off to the side. Gunn's heartbeat calmed considerably as the 2 terrorists lowered their guns in unison and turned their attention back to their guard duty. He moved casually until he was standing alongside them so his line of fire would not strike the hostages. Then, while keeping his eyes aimed at the miserable people sitting on the ground between the track rails, and without even looking at the 2 guards, he squeezed the trigger. Amar and his men were on the verge of total exhaustion when they reached the outskirts of the mine. The persistent downpour had turned their clothes sodden and heavy. They struggled over a long mound of tailings and thankfully entered a shed that once housed mining equipment parts. Amar dropped onto a wooden bench, his head drooped on his chest, his breath coming in labored gasps. He looked up as Ibn entered with another man.
"This is Mustafa Osman," said Ibn. "He says an armed group of commandos have killed their group leader and barricaded themselves in the crushing mill with our helicopter."
Amar's lips drew back in anger.
"How could you let this happen?"
Osman's black eyes registered panic.
"We had no warning," he stammered. "They must have come down from the mountain. They subdued the sentries, seized the train, and shot up our living quarters. When we launched our counterattack, they fired on us from the crushing mill building."
"Casualties?" Amar demanded coldly.
"There are 7 of us left."
The nightmare was worse than Amar thought. "How many in their assault party?"
20, maybe 30.
7 of you have 30 of them under siege," snarled Amar, his tone heavy with sarcasm.
"Their number. This time the truth or Ibn here will slit your throat."
Osman avoided Amar's eyes. He was frozen in fear.
"There is no way of knowing for certain," he mumbled. "Perhaps 4 or more."
4 men did all this," said Amar, aghast.
He was seething, but too disciplined to allow his anger to take control. "What of the helicopter? Is it damaged?" Osman seemed to brighten a degree.
"No, we were careful not to fire at the section of the building where it is parked. I'd stake my father's honor it has not been hit."
"Only Allah knows whether the commandos have sabotaged it," said Ibn.
"We'll all see Allah soon if we don't recapture it in flying condition," Amar said quietly. "The only way we can overpower the defenders is to strike hard and penetrate from all sides and crush them by sheer weight of numbers."
"Perhaps we can use the hostages to bargain our way out," said Ibn hopefully.
Amar nodded. A possibility. Americans are weak when it comes to death threats. I'll parley with our unknown scourge while you position the men for the assault. Take care, Suleiman Aziz. Be ready to attack when I remove my mask.
Ibn gave a slight bow and immediately began giving orders to the men. Amar ripped a tattered curtain from one window. The fabric had once been white, but was now faded to a dingy yellow. It would have to do, he thought. He tied it to an old broom and stepped from the shed. He moved along a row of miners' bunkhouses, keeping out of sight of the crushing mill until he was across the street. Then he extended the curtain around a corner and waved it up and down. No gunfire tore through the ragged flag of truce, but nothing else happened either. Amar tried shouting in English.
"We wish to talk!"
After several moments, a voice yelled back.
"No hablo inglés!"
Amar was taken back momentarily. Chilean security police? They were far more efficient than he thought. He could speak fluently in English and get by in French, but he knew little Spanish. Hesitation would get him nowhere. He had to see who stood in his way of a successful escape. He held up the makeshift flag, raised his free hand, and stepped out onto the road in front of the crushing mill. The word for peace he knew was paz, so he shouted it several times. Finally, a man opened the main door and slowly limped onto the road, stopped a few paces away, and faced him. The stranger was tall, with intensely green eyes that never flickered and yet ignored the dozen gun barrels poking through windows and doorways in his direction. The eyes locked on Amar only. The black hair was long and wavy. Skin weathered a deep copper from long exposure to sun. Slightly bushy eyebrows with firm lips fixed in a slight grin. All lent the masculine but not quite handsome face a deceptive look of humorous detachment, with only a trace of cold hardness. There was a cut in one cheek that oozed blood and a wound on one thigh that was heavily bandaged under the slashed fabric. The shape might have been lean under the bulky, out-of-place ski suit, but Amar could not make a clear assessment. One hand was bare while the other was gloved and hung loosely beneath one sleeve of the ski jacket. 3 seconds were all Amar needed to read this devil, 3 seconds to know he was facing a dangerous man. He searched his mind for the few meager words of Spanish stored there.
"Can we talk?"
Yes, that would do for openers.
"Podemos hablar?" he shouted.
The suggestion of a grin widened into a casual smile.
"Por qué no?"
Amar translated that as "why not?"
"Hacer capitular usted?"
"Why don't we cut the crap?" it said suddenly in English. "Your Spanish is worse than mine. The answer to your question is no, we're not going to surrender." Amar was too much a pro not to recover immediately, yet he was confounded by the fact that his adversary wore expensive skiing clothes instead of battle gear. The first possibility that crossed his mind was CIA.
"May I ask your name?"
"Dirk Pitt."
"I am Suleiman Aziz Amar."
"I don't really give a damn who you are," Pitt said coldly.
"As you wish, Mr. Pitt," Amar remarked calmly.
Then one of his eyebrows lifted slightly.
"You by chance related to Senator George Pitt?"
"I don't travel in political circles."
"But you know him. I can see a resemblance. The son, perhaps?"
"Can we get on with this? I had to interrupt a perfectly good champagne brunch to come out here in the rain."
Amar laughed. The man was incredible.
"You have something of mine. I'd like it returned in first-rate condition."
"You're speaking, of course, of one unmarked helicopter."
"Of course."
"Finders keepers. You want it, pal? You come and get it."
Amar clenched and unclenched his fists impatiently. This was not going as he had hoped. He continued in a silky voice.
"Some of my men will die, you will die, and your father will most certainly die if you do not turn it over to me."
Pitt didn't blink.
"You forgot to throw in Hala Kamil and Presidents De Lorenzo and Hassan. And don't neglect to include yourself. No reason you shouldn't fertilize the grass, too."
Amar stared at Pitt, his anger slowly rising.
"I can't believe your stubborn stupidity. What will you gain by more bloodletting?"
"To put the skids under scumbags like you," said Pitt harshly. "You want a war, you declare it. But don't sneak around butchering women and children and taking innocent hostages who can't fight back. The terror stops here. I'm not bound by any law but my own. For every one of us you murder, we'll bury 5 of you.
I didn't come out here in the wet to discuss our political differences, said Amar, fighting to control his wrath. Tell me if the helicopter has been damaged.
Doesn't have a scratch. And I might add that your pilots are still fit to fly. That make you happy?
You would be wise to surrender your weapons and turn over my craft and flight crew.
Pitt shrugged. Screw you.
Amar was shaken by his failure to intimidate Pitt. His voice turned abrupt and cold.
How many men do you have? 4, perhaps 5? We outnumber you 8-1.
Pitt nodded his head at the bodies scattered beside the crushing mill.
You're going to have to play catch-up ball. The way I see it, you're about 9 stiffs down on the scoreboard.
Then, as an afterthought, he said, Before I forget, I give you my word I won't sabotage your copter. It's yours in pristine shape, providing you can take it. But harm any of the hostages, and I blow it from here to the nearest junkyard. That's the only deal I'll make.
That is your final word?
For now, yes.
A thought crystallized in Amar's mind, and he was swept by a sudden revelation.
It was you, he rasped. You led the American Special Forces here.
Luck gets most of the credit, Pitt said modestly. But after I found the wreck of the General Bravo and a misplaced roll of plastic, it all fell into place. Amar stood there for a moment in profound astonishment, then recovered and said,
You do your powers of deduction an injustice, Mr. Pitt. I readily concede the coyote has run the fox to ground.
Fox, said Pitt. You flatter yourself, don't you mean maggot?
Amar looked at Pitt through narrowed eyes. I'm personally going to kill you, Pitt, and I'm going to take great pleasure in seeing your body shot to pieces. What say you to that?
There was no fury in Pitt's eyes, no hatred etched in his face. He stared back at Amar with a kind of bemused disgust one might display in exchanging looks with a cobra behind glass at a snake farm.
Give my regards to Broadway, he said, turning his back on Amar and walking casually back to the door of the crushing mill.
Furious, Amar hurled down the flag of truce and strode swiftly in the opposite direction. As he moved, he eased an American Ruger P-85 semi-automatic 9mm from the inside pocket of his coat. Suddenly he whirled, whipped off his mask, and went into the classic crouched stance with the Ruger gripped in both hands. The instant the sights lined up dead center on Pitt's back, Amar pulled the trigger 6 times in lightning succession. He saw the bullets tear into the middle of Pitt's ski jacket in a ragged grouping of uneven holes, watched as the concentrated impact knocked his hated enemy stumbling forward into the wall of the crushing mill. Amar waited for Pitt to fall. His antagonist, he knew with firm certainty, was dead before striking the ground.